Let's all bow before Almighty Yahweh. Father, we come before you today. We thank you for the blessings of the day. We pray that what we do here at this ministry would be a blessing to you and blessing to others. We pray that you'd be with those today not here. We'd pray that your healing would be upon them, and pray that you would certainly be with your people no matter where they're at throughout this world, worshiping you in spirit and truth. And we just praise you and give you honor, and we ask all this in Yahshua's beloved name. Hallelujah. Amen. Y'all may be seated. It's a blessing to be here today. Blessing to see all of you here. I'd like to extend a warm greeting to those online. We're today want to continue with the part two of our quest for the Lost Temple Mount. I want to begin by reviewing what we talked about last message. We looked at a lot, and I would really try to focus today because we will have a quiz near the end, and everything, for the most part, is within this message. So here's a summary of the first part, or part one. It says, the City of David is the ancient city of Jerusalem and is synonymous with Zion, Salem, and Mount Moriah. That's key. That's really key. Scripturally, the city of Jerusalem is Zion. It is Salem. Of course, Salem is just another name for Jerusalem, and it is Mount Moriah. Now, we also know Zion is the location of the temple, and this is where Yahweh dwelt. We also know that Solomon's temple was built over the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, and the reason that's important is because it needs to be flat. And as we saw under the Dome of the Rock, it's anything but flat. Another thing we reviewed was during the 7th century CE, 70 Jewish families from Tiberias relocated from Jerusalem, or relocated from Tiberias to Jerusalem, and requested to be near the Pool of Siloam and the temple. Lastly here, the Gihon, actually we have another slide. The Gihon Spring is the only natural water source in Jerusalem and is located within the city of David, a third of a mile from the traditional Temple Mount. That's probably one of the biggest reasons why I believe what I believe on this is simply that the water source is crucial. And it's not within the traditional Temple Mount. It's in the city of David. According to Aristeus, which was an Alexandrian Jew, 2nd, 3rd century BCE, and Tacitus, which was a Roman historian, 2nd century CE, there was a spring-like reservoir gushing from the temple, and these men saw this. Lastly here, Yahshua the Messiah prophesied in the Olivet Prophecy that not one stone would remain upon another in reference to the temple. Now, as we see here, we spent a lot of time in part one looking at the geography, including the Gihon Spring, where the Gihon Spring is located, why the Gihon Spring is so important. We also focused on Yahshua's prophecy in Mark 13. Or today, I want to continue with that. I want to continue with Yahshua's prophecy and some of the historical accounts of the destruction of Jerusalem and also the city of David, or the temple, I should say. Also want to share some information on the 10th Legion. This is another reason why I believe what I do, these two points, the 10th Legion. It's really important to understand the 10th Legion. We're also going to review what Josephus and other historians say about the Fortress Antonia. That's crucial. It's amazing, actually, the belief that so many scholars have in reference to Josephus and what he says. Lastly, I'm going to consider what I call the Paul dilemma, and we'll talk more about that near the end of the message. But there's a dilemma with Paul, believe it or not, with the temple. And showing that, again, just a contradiction between what we believe or what scholarship believes today and what is found through history and also through Yahweh's word. Now, I know we read Mark 13 in part one, but I want to begin today, though, by reading it one more time. Such an important passage. Mark 13, 1 through 2. It says, and as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said unto him, Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here. So notice they say buildings here. It's not just the inner sanctuary, so many believe. And Yahshua answered, said unto them, seest thou these great buildings? There shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. This passage is known as the Olivet Prophecy, Mark 13. We also know it's found in Matthew 24 and Luke 21. As we talked about in part one, we see here Yahshua prophesying that not one stone would remain upon another within the temple. Not only do we see the foundation of the temple today remaining, but we also see what they call the Western or the Wailing Wall. And I believe, if my memory serves me right, that that's about 10,000 stones, I believe. The evidence of what remains on the traditional Temple Mount seems, in my mind, to contradict the prophecy Yahshua left here within the Olivet Prophecy. Now, along with the temple, we also know that Yahshua prophesied in Luke 19:43 that Jerusalem itself would suffer a similar fate. So I want to read that as well. So here's what Yahshua says, Luke 19:43-44 says, "And he approached Jerusalem and saw the city. He wept over it and said, 'If you, even you, had not only known of this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another.'" Now, we know historically this is precisely what happened when Rome attacked the city of Jerusalem. Rome encircled Jerusalem and destroyed the city and many within it. Yahshua said here, again, as we saw in Mark 13, that not one stone would be left upon another. As we see here, not only was the temple demolished, but Yahshua here, he refers to the city. He says that the city is going to be demolished. Not one stone would remain upon another. Does it make sense that so much of the Temple Mount would remain today, considering the prophecies we find here in Mark 13 and Luke 19? Would it make sense, again, to have this foundation within the Temple Mount and also the Wailing Wall remaining as it does now? Based on the scriptural evidence, it's hard to believe for me that Rome would have allowed these things to remain. Along with Yahshua's prophecies, we find many historical accounts also talking about the destruction of Jerusalem by Titus and the Roman army. I want to share with you some of those, but in part one, we heard from Josephus, Epiphanius, and also Eusebius. I want to share again more references today with this, and I want to begin with something we find from Eusebius. We're going to refer to Eusebius a few times. This is within his proof of the Gospels, book 8. And he says this, a hill called Zion in Jerusalem, the buildings there, the temple, the Holy of Holies, the altar, and whatever else there was dedicated to the glory of God has been utterly, utterly removed or shaken in the fulfillment of the word. He's referring to the fulfillment of Yahshua's prophecy. Notice here what Eusebius says about Jerusalem, about the holy city and the temple. He says here that it was utterly shaken and removed. As we see here, he's referring to the temple, the Holy of Holies, and whatever else was dedicated to the glory, to the worship of our Father in heaven. I think we can safely say that Eusebius was referring to more than just the inner sanctuary, as many believe. And that's the theory that many believe. They say this is just the temple itself, not the outer walls, and that's how they explain the existence today of the Wailing Wall. But again, Yahshua in the prophecy said that the buildings would be torn down. And we find here Eusebius confirming that whatever is holy, the temple, whatever is dedicated, all of it, was torn down. Based on what we see here, this would have included the outer portions of the temple. Now, Eusebius makes another reference to this, again, in proof of the Gospels. This is book 5. He says there, their ancient holy place, at any rate, and their temple are to this day as much destroyed as Sodom. Now think about that statement for just a moment. Eusebius here compares the destruction of the temple and the city to the devastation that Sodom suffered in the Old Testament. We know that the city of Sodom was utterly, completely consumed. During our last trip to Israel 2016, we had the chance to visit this site with Don Esposito, Elder Don Esposito. The city of Gomorrah, at least was believed to be the city of Gomorrah. And as we know, Gomorrah suffered the same fate as the city of Sodom. To give you a glimpse of what this destruction might have looked like, here's a few slides, a few pictures from what many believe, again, is the ancient city of Gomorrah. It's an amazing place. So there's nothing here. This is, again, a picture of the city of what's believed to be the city of Gomorrah. All you have is ash and sulfur. You can actually still find sulfur balls within this location. And by the way, when you go up to Masada and you look down from Masada, you can see this. And what's amazing is the shade of brown is different. In the Judean desert, it's kind of, it's all a light brown, but this is almost a white. It's really amazing the distinction you see from Masada. Once you get high enough, you can see all of this, the Dead Sea and, of course, Gomorrah. And you can see a contrast between where they believe, some believe, Gomorrah is, and the Judean desert. So here's another picture. By the way, just as a quick note, Don Esposito, we were walking along the banks and the hills, and he says, don't stand on the top, you can fall through. Because it really is just ash. It really is amazing. And here's I don't know if it petrified, but hard ash has been compressed. You can actually, I have some samples of this in my office. So this is just a few, I believe I said, yeah, a few photos of, again, what many believe to be the place of Gomorrah. And again, Eusebius compares the destruction of Jerusalem to Sodom. And again, we know that Gomorrah suffered a similar fate. And as we see here from the photos, nothing remains today of Gomorrah except sulfur and ash. So assuming that Eusebius was not exaggerating, is it possible that the Roman army left the foundation of the temple and, again, I think it's 10,000 stones of the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, intact? Is it possible that Eusebius was, again, just exaggerating? Of course, Josephus would also have to be exaggerating. We see examples, and we'll see examples from him in just a moment. But again, based on Yahshua's prophecies and what we find here in Eusebius, I don't see it. Now, I do want to share a reference from Josephus. This is from Wars of the Jews, Volume 6. It says, "And truly the very view itself was a melancholy thing, for those places which were adorned with trees and pleasant gardens were now become desolate country every way, and his trees were all cut down. Nor could any foreigner that had formerly seen Judea and the most beautiful suburbs of the city, and now saw it as a desert, but lament and mourn sadly at so great a change. For the war had laid all signs of beauty quite waste. For if anyone that had not known the place before had come on a sudden set into it now, would he have not known it?" Again, think about that. This is Josephus, and he's saying if somebody was not real familiar with this, they would never know. They would never know the destruction was that great. We see again the level of just utter obliteration that Jerusalem suffered by the Romans. It says here that the entire city was desolate, that it was unrecognizable. The slight last statement here by Josephus shows again just the absolute devastation that the city suffered by the hands of the Romans. Here are two photos. Again, we've all seen the Temple Mount. We again see the foundation of the Temple Mount still standing, still intact. And of course, we also see the Wailing Wall or the Western Wall. But these photos are from the 1900s. Was unable to find an exact date. But here's a photo. So that's the city of David. Do you recognize the city of David? Is there anything there? No, there's nothing there because the devastation was so great that it was utterly consumed. There's a few buildings, but it was consumed completely and utterly, as we find from Josephus and Eusebius and our Savior. Here's another photo. The square is the city of David. And again, there's not much there, is there? This is, of course, before the excavations, before they realized even where the city of David was. But again, there's nothing there. There is absolutely nothing there within the city of David. Except for a few buildings, again, they're just desolate, as we find from Josephus. And as we heard from our Savior in his prophecy. Now, Josephus also speaks more about this in chapter 7 of Wars of the Jews. He says, and he came to Jerusalem in his progress and compared the melancholy condition he saw it then in, with the ancient glory of the city, with the greatness of its present ruins, as well as its ancient splendor. He could not pity the destruction of the city, yet there was no small quantity of the riches that had been in that city still found among the ruins, a great deal of which the Romans dug up. So you see, after the destruction of Jerusalem and after the conquest, the Romans dug up the foundations of the city. There was absolutely nothing remaining. It says the Romans dug up by the greatest part was discovered by those who were captives. And so they, the Romans, carried it away. I mean the gold and the silver and the rest of that most precious furniture which the Jews had, and which the owners had treasured up underground against the uncertainties of war. So we see again here Jerusalem was not only completely and utterly destroyed, but we find that the Romans literally dug up the city. After Jerusalem fell, the Roman army began looking for valuables. They began looking for the gold and silver. And to find this, they were digging up the city. I've read that the Jews would hide their valuables. They would dig a hole. They would dig and put it in the earth. And I've heard also, and I don't know if it's true or not, but I've heard also that the temple, when it burned, the heat was so great that it melted the gold. And the gold was underneath, so they had to dig the gold out. So we find again that not only did the Romans completely consume the city, but afterwards the Romans also dug up the city, destroyed the city. And that's why after the Roman conquest, there was nothing remaining, there was nothing left. As Joshua prophesied, not one stone would be upon another. And as we saw in the photo, as we see here in the photo, there is nothing. There was nothing remaining of the city of David. And the city of David is Jerusalem. The city of David is Zion. And after the Romans had conquered the city of David and Jerusalem, there was nothing there except for the Temple Mount. Find another reference. This is from Gregory of Nyssa. It says, upon the time of the manifestation of Christ, the royal palaces in Jerusalem were in all their splendor. There was their far-famed temple. But now, no traces even of their temple can be recognized. Now think about that for just a moment. No traces of their temple can be recognized. And yet we know, and we can certainly see the Temple Mount. So if no traces of the temple could be recognized, how would we explain the Temple Mount and the Wailing Wall? Surely they would recognize the outer wall. Surely they would recognize the foundation. But here, according to Gregory, that there was no recognition of the temple. And he goes on to say, and their splendid city has been left in ruins, so that there remains to the Jews nothing of the ancient institutions. It was completely and utterly consumed. While by the command of those who rule over them, the very ground of Jerusalem, which they so venerated, is forbidden to them, so they could not return. Now, Gregory of Nyssa, he was a 4th century bishop, considered to be part of the Nicene Fathers. What do we learn from this man? He says here, again, that the temple was unrecognizable. That the temple, where the temple was unrecognized. There was nothing to recognize. And that also would apply to the city, that the city was in ruins. This is similar to what we find with Eusebius. This is like the description we see from Josephus. Based on this, I think we can safely say that there was nothing left of the old city or the temple or where they worshiped. except for one thing. Except for one thing. And this is a big key. Except for one thing. Now, we find this in Josephus, and I believe this is an account of the general, I believe, of the that was at Masada. But it's in Josephus, in his writings. Josephus, Wars of the Jews. He says, there is now that great city, the metropolis of the Jewish nation, which was fortified by so many walls round about, which had so many fortresses and large towers to defend it, which could hardly contain the instruments prepared for the war, and which had so many 10,000s of men to fight for it. Where is this city that was believed to have God himself inhabiting therein? Now listen to what he says. This is from Josephus. It is now demolished to the very foundation, but that monument of it preserved. So what monument? I mean the camp of those that destroyed it. This is from Josephus. Josephus says that the very foundations of the city were demolished. Except for the monument that is the camp of the Romans. Now what monument, what camp of the Romans is Josephus referring to? From a historical standpoint, the only possible answer is Fortress Antonia. Fortress Antonia was the camp of the Romans. This is where the 10th Legion was. We'll talk more about the 10th Legion. This was the Roman fort that existed during the time of the Messiah and also the destruction of the city. And here we find, according to Josephus, the only thing that remained was that monument, was that Roman fort. So according to Josephus, the only substantial thing was Fortress Antonia. Everything else within the city was demolished. Now, where do you suppose this fort would be located today? Where do we see evidence of this fort today? Or what's existing? What's still standing even today? The Temple Mount. According to Josephus, the only thing that stood, the only thing that existed, the only thing that was still intact after the Romans sacked Jerusalem was the fort. And the only thing in existence today of that time frame is the Temple Mount. So I believe that's proof, evidence, very high evidence of what we see today is not the location of the temple, but of the ancient fort of the Romans. More than likely, it was not the traditional Temple Mount location, but again, where Fortress Antonia stood. And we're going to see more evidence for this, but that's a intriguing quote, very informative quote from Josephus. Now, I want to talk about the 10th Legion. I want to kind of transition now for just a few moments and talk about the 10th Legion. Now, when Jerusalem was attacked, there were multiple legions. There were five, I believe, legions, or four legions, I believe. Four or five, but anyway, there were multiple legions. The 10th Legion was one of the legions who came against Jerusalem. So what was the 10th Legion? Well, here's an article I found online. I wanted to share it with you. It's a good article, newhistorian.com. And the article is entitled Remainders of the 10th Roman Legion Unearthed in Jerusalem. So they found evidence of the 10th Legion. It says bricks in the bathhouse was stamped with the name of the 10th Roman Legion, which was part of the takeover of the Jewish Jerusalem. The soldiers were garrisoned there until 300 CE. By the way, that's something you might want to remember. The 10th Roman Legion, Legio Tenfrentensis, was created by Augustus Caesar between 41 and 40 BCE, specifically to fight in the civil war which marked the beginning of the end of the Republic of Rome. The 10th Legion existed until at least the 410s. So we see here some history in the 10th Legion. We see that it was a legion. The most important thing to recognize is, again, that it was a legion coming from the Latin legio. I'll explain why this is important in just a few moments. We also find here that the 10th Legion was established by Augustus Caesar between 41 and 40 BC in response to the civil war in Rome. You know, I'm afraid, just as a side note, we're kind of seeing the same thing here in this nation. Rome was a republic when it was established, and then certainly lost that, and there were civil war within Rome, and again, that's when we find the establishment of this legion. Now, we see here that this legion was established or was stationed within Jerusalem until 300 CE, another date you may want to remember. Now, what do we know historically about Roman legions? What do we know about Roman legions? Well, here's a book. It's entitled The Imperial Roman Army, and we're going to read page 160. It says that with almost 5,000 men, a legionary camp was the equivalent of a town. That's an important concept to understand. A legion was the equivalent of a town. Consequently, everything that was essential for the daily life of such a community, hospitals, stores, workshops, baths, as well as public lavatories, was to be found. So everything that you would have within a city or a town, you would have within a camp. So we find here, number one, that a legion of troops, it says, was about 5,000 men. Now, we're going to find evidence that that number was possibly a bit higher during the time of our Savior. Keep in mind that this doesn't include support staff. Some believe, and again, it's hard to find absolute evidence for this, but some believe, based on the fact that they would also have support staff, personnel, that the number was possibly as high as 10,000 men. Now, we also see here that a legionary camp, again, consisted of an average city. Anything you would see in a city, anything you would see in a town, a legionary camp would contain. So it was a self-contained city. And the reason for that is when they were in hostile territory, that's where they stayed. And we see similar things to this. I don't know what the names of these places are, truthfully. But if you go to Iraq or some of these other places, we have bases. Maybe just bases. We have bases within hostile areas. When you're within those bases, you're safe for the most part. Or when you were within these legionary camps, you were safe. But like these legionary camps today, the military, you go to these big bases, they have everything you would need. You don't have to go outside of the base. And the same thing is true with these camps, with these legions, with these troops. Everything they needed, they had. And this would include things like we find here, stores, workshops, baths, other conveniences, whatever they would require, they would have within that city. Now, secondary witness to the number of a legion we find from the Encyclopedia of Biblical, Theological, and Ecclesiastical Literature. I've said that many times, so I'm getting pretty good at the title there. But this is a great reference, very thorough reference. And here's what it says about a legion. It says, a legion appears to have originally contained about 3,000 men. So originally 3,000. It says, and to have risen gradually to twice that number and even more. In about the time of Christ, it seems to have consisted of 6,000 men. And this was exclusive of horsemen who usually formed an additional body amounted to 1/10 of the infantry. So we find the number possibly was a bit higher. We find here originally it began with 3,000 and then it grew to about 6,000 or even more possibly. But during the time of the Messiah, according to this reference, the size of a legion was 6,000. And again, this does not account for support staff. Now, why is it important that we understand this number? Why is it important that we understand that a legion is 6,000 troops? Why is it important that we understand that the 10th Legion was a legion? Kind of sounds a bit nonsensical asking it that way, but some believe that the 10th Legion was not a legion, but a cohort. And we'll talk more about that in just a moment. Where it shows, number one, it shows the absurdity of the current theory as to the size and location of Fortress Antonia. So let's take a look and let's talk about this Roman fort and what we find through scholarship. To begin with, I want to share with you a model that we visited at the Israeli Museum. By the way, if you ever get out there, the Israeli Museum is just amazing. But it has a large model of ancient Jerusalem. And here you see it. And it's in red. I have a circle there. Supposedly, that's this legionary camp. That's Fortress Antonia. So you have Fortress Antonia here, and this is the Temple Mount. Does that seem right to you? Now, I know many of you have not been to Israel, but you've seen pictures of the Temple Mount, and you can see how this appendage from the temple, how small it is in comparison. Do you believe that that could hold 6,000 troops? That's the main thing. Now, this model here was designed by Michael Avayona, an Israeli historian and geographer, supposedly, and I say supposedly because it's kind of hard to believe that he did when you read Josephus, but supposedly he used Josephus as a model for this model. Now, again, the circle here represents Fortress Antonia. The first thing you may notice is, again, how small this is in comparison to the traditional Temple Mount. The fact is, based on the model, there's nowhere near enough room for a Roman legion. And that's, again, why it's important that we understand the size of a Roman legion. So how does scholarship explain this? Obviously, they know that the current model would not sustain or hold 6,000 men. So how do they explain this? So they will say that the 10th Legion was not a legion, but a cohort, even though we know it was a legion. Now, a cohort was about 600 men. So you have 6,000 or 600. And this is their way of getting around this small appendage that they call Fortress Antonia. Now, there are two issues with this. As we've already seen, the 10th Legion is not a cohort. It's a legion. It's what it is in Latin. It's a legion. It's not a cohort. Number two, as we'll see in just a moment, Josephus, which was an eyewitness, describes this Roman fortress, and it describes how large this fortress was. So based on the evidence, I have a hard time, again, believing that what we see in the Israeli Museum was what we would have seen historically. So what does Josephus say about Fortress Antonia? I'm going to do quite a bit of reading here. Normally, I like to abstain from so much reading, but I believe here it's kind of important that we understand the description from a historical standpoint. So here's, to begin with, here's what Josephus says about the temple. He says, now on the north side of the temple was built a citadel. So it was on the north side, we know that, whose walls were square and strong and of extraordinary firmness. The citadel was built by the kings of the Hasmonean, which is Maccabees, Hasmonean race, who were also high priests before Herod. And they called it the Tower, in which were reposited the vestments of the high priest, which the high priest only put on at the time when he was to offer sacrifice. But for the tower itself, when Herod the king of the Jews had fortified it more firmly than before in order to secure and guard the temple, he gratified Antonius, who was his friend and the Roman ruler, and then gave it the name of the Tower of Antonia. To continue on here, this is another reference from Josephus, Wars of the Jews. It says, now as to the Tower of Antonia, was situated at the corner of two cloisters. Now, cloister is a covered bridge, of the court of the temple. So there were bridges between the Fortress Antonia and the temple. It was the work of King Herod, wherein he demonstrated his natural magnanimity. In the first place, the rock itself was covered over the smooth pieces of stone from his foundation, both in ornament and that anyone who would either try to get up or to go down it might not be able to hold his feet upon it. Next to this, and before you come to the edifice of the tower itself, there was a wall 3 cubits high, but within that wall all the space of the Tower of Antonia itself was built upon to the height of 40 cubits. The inward parts had the largeness and form of a palace. It being parted into all kinds of rooms and other conveniences is, now listen to this. Again, this is Josephus. And this is a description of Fortress Antonia, that small appendage that we find in the Israeli Museum. It says, it being parted into all kinds of rooms and other conveniences, such as courts and palaces for bathing, the broad places, spaces for camps, insomuch that by having all conveniences that cities wanted, it might seem, to be composed of several cities. So Josephus describes Fortress Antonia as not only a city, but cities within cities. By its magnificence, it seemed a palace. And as the entire structure resembled that of a tower, it contained also four other distinct towers at its four corners. So each corner had a tower for observation, whereof the other were but 50 cubits high, whereas that which lay upon the southeast corner was 70 cubits high. You may want to remember that, by the way, 70 cubits high. Or how much higher? And how much higher was it? You had the 50 cubits and then 70 cubits. That from thence the whole temple might be viewed. So from this southeast corner, it was 20 cubits higher, 70 cubits in all, and they could view the temple from that location. But on the corner where it joined to the two cloisters of the temple, it had passages down to them both, through which the guard, for there were always lay in this tower a Roman legion. So notice, the Roman legion was within the camp. It says, went several ways among the cloisters, with their arms in order to watch the people, that they might not there attempt to make any invocations, for the temple was a fortress that guarded the city, as was the Tower of Antonia, a guard to the temple. So Antonia, Fortress Antonia, was a guard to the temple. And again, on that corner, they had that tower that would watch what was occurring within the city of David and also the temple. And in that tower were the guards of those three. There was also a particular fortress belonging to the upper city, which was Herod's palace, but for the hill Bezetha, it was divided from the tower Antonia, as we have already told you. And as that hill, now listen to this, this is an important point. It says, and as that hill on which the tower of Antonia stood was the highest of these three. So there's three hills there. And according to Josephus, Antonia stood on the highest of those hills. So did it adjoin to the new city, and was the only place that hindered the sight of so massive that you could not see the city. You could not see the palace, he says. And again, let's just go back real quick. I'm going to show you this. So this is north. So if you're coming north, according to Josephus, you can't see the temple. Now, here's what they propose to be the Fortress Antonia. So look at that. Tell me, if you're coming north, you're coming from this direction, and you're looking this direction, you're here, would this obscure your view? But according to Josephus, when you're coming north, you would not be able to see the temple. I think I have one more here. Actually, I think I have two more. Okay, this is from the Ancient Roman City, page 250. It says, an army legion pitching a permanent or semi-permanent camp needed an orderly layout of streets, barracks, chapels, parade grounds, officers' quarters, and a sturdy defensive wall. A standardized plan permitted soldiers to feel securely oriented within camps built at every different locations. Indeed, Polypius wrote that the legionary camps he knew in the 2nd century BC were similar to cities. So again, we see just a book talking about the ancient Roman city, talking about a legionary camp and comparing it to a city. And notice also that when they were within this city, when they were within this camp, they were safe. They were safe. Like if, again, you go to a camp, a base of some sort now, you're safe. I forget what they call that. Is it green zone? There's a term for that with ancient or with modern military. But anyway, same concept. As you're safe in a base, you're safe in this can. I can't hear you. That's fine. It's the concept's there. So let's see here. One other. I think we have one other. Yes. So the Jerusalem Temple Mount myth says here now, so it happened that this fight was, for the most part, a stationary one, wherein the soldiers went on and came back in a short time, and suddenly, for there was no long space of ground, the italicized word should say only a stead's distance, meaning 600 feet. So 600 feet between the temple, or between the Roman fort and the temple. It says, for either of their flights or pursuits. This critical description, deliberately mistranslated by traditionalist translators, has caused non-Greek readers, scholars, to interpret other descriptions of Josephus to mean Fort Antonius stood flush against the temple's north wall when it was actually 600 feet away. Just as Josephus speaks about cloisters or bridges between Fortress Antonia and the temple, and here we just find additional evidence for that. Now, I know we've reviewed a lot of information, so I thought the best way of doing this would give you a list. Here's the points that we should be taking away from this. So point one here is Fortress Antonia was originally a fortress built by the Hasmoneans. And again, who were the Hasmoneans? These were the Maccabees. Herod further fortified the fortress to protect the temple and gave it the name Fortress Antonia after Mark Antony. The temple and Fort Antonia were approximately how far apart? 600 feet apart, connected by two cloisters or two covered bridges. We also find historically that it contained all kinds of conveniences. This would have included courts, palaces, were places of bathing, as we find here, broad spaces for camps. It was also compared to a city or a city within cities. Now, here's a few things you may want to remember. It had four, now this is in reference to four corners measuring 50 cubits. Now, 50 cubits is about 75 feet. Those are tall towers. Except for the southeast corner, which measured 70 cubits, which is about 105 feet. Now, think about that for just a moment. 105 feet, they had a tower. Why did they have this tower? They had this tower so that they could watch over. Was to guard Jerusalem. So the temple was here and then Jerusalem's here, where the fortress was to guard the temple. We also know that it was located in the highest of the three hills. We read that. Josephus shares that. And from the north, and this is a really big point when we look at the current model, but from the north, according to, I believe it was Josephus, he said that Fortress Antonia obscured or blocked the view of the temple, that you could not see the temple if you were coming north. And as we see from the current model at the Israeli Museum, this simply would not be an issue to see the temple. You know, for me, one of the main contradictions is, again, the size and the placement of Fortress Antonia. This is one of the main reasons why I believe what I do on this. It just simply doesn't make sense to suppose that a Roman legion could sit within the space they have designated within the Israeli Museum with Fortress Antonia. Now, I want to share some dimensions with you of the, before we do that, let's look at this here. So, this is an illustration courtesy of the Associates of for Scriptural Knowledge, askelm.com, if you want to look at it. But here's a great description. So we see the temple, and we have a distance. This would be considered more the oval, but the 600 feet here with the covered bridges, as we find with the Josephus. Josephus speaks about the tower, again, being 105 feet tall, higher than the other corners. And it was built on the highest of the three hills. So this, again, is a model based on what we actually find from Josephus. And you can see the contradictions of what we find with, again, the model. So what are some of the issues we find here? What are some of the problems we find with the current model at the Israeli Museum, or the believed location for Fortress Antonia? Or it's much too small for Roman legion, we know that. And that's why they will say it wasn't a legion, it was a cohort, but Josephus confirms that it was a legion. History confirms that it was a legion. The southeast corner is the same size as the other towers. So I don't know how this man could have read Josephus and missed such an important point. Because Josephus says that that corner, that southeast corner, was another 20 cubits high, higher than the other corners. And again, we find no bridges or distance between Fortress Antonia and the Temple Mount. And yet we know that Josephus speaks about cloisters or covered bridges between the temple and Fortress Antonia. So there's so many there's so many things wrong with this illustration. It does not follow Josephus. It does not follow any of the traditional information, the historical information, I should say, that we have. So let's talk about the dimensions of the Temple Mount. So the Temple Mount has a trapezoid, basically, and the on one side, the west side, is 1,033 feet, and on the south, it's 918 feet. Now, it gives us a total of about 37 acres. That's how large the Temple Mount area is. So one of the things I find just absolutely amazing is the legionary camp. So I want to share just a few with you. But before that, let's talk about a typical Roman fort. We've already heard this in Josephus and other places, but this is from Ancient History Encyclopedia. And talks about a typical Roman fort. Now, this would be a legionary fort. It says, the plan of the layout of a typical Roman fort. Buildings included barracks, accommodations for the commanding officer, granaries, workshops, a hospital, a cistern, and in the case of larger forts, a number of shops or a market, and Roman baths. The large central building is the Principia, where assemblies were held, the legions' standards were kept, as well as an arsenal and offices. So we find here again just some of the items we would find in a typical Roman camp. Again, these were not small appendages. These were cities. And they contained, as we know, all the conveniences known or would have been needed. And again, I think the best description would be a large military camp. Again, if you've been to a large military camp, they have everything you need right there within the camp, especially when it's in a hostile area. And they're not going to have to, they're not going to force you to go out and do anything outside of those walls. Everything you need to do, they need to have within those walls. So let's look at some examples. So this one here is from a Carlean, Wells, I believe is how you pronounce that. And it was accompanied by the 10th or 2nd Legion, 5,500 troops. So right there along with what we know with the 10th Legion. And it's about 50 acres in size. So we find a similar shape and we find a similar size. In this case, it's much quite a bit larger. So this is a Roman camp in Neuss, Germany, and it was 80 CE. It's 59 acres, and the belief is that it possibly occupied the by the 19th Legion. So again, this is a typical Roman fort, larger than what we see on the Temple Mount. We also see a Roman fort in Germany, Haltern, Germany. This one actually held two legions, according to history, and it was 85 acres in size. So these camps were large. These camps were not small. They were, again, out at small appendages. I'm not sure what the actual size is, the proposed size of Fortress Antonia based on the Israeli Museum's model, but it's much, much smaller, maybe an acre, maybe. And yet we see here all the Roman forts or fortresses. They were much, much larger than certainly what we see in the model. Now I want to share with you a video. It covers a lot of what we've already talked about, but I just wanted to kind of incorporate this video. It's only 3 minutes. I think it's 30 minutes in total. But a video that Elder Don Esposito and I did, standing on the Mount of Olives, looking down toward the Temple Mount in the City of David. And by the way, that is a really, really great location because you can see everything. You can see, again, the Temple Mount. You can see the City of David. Everything right there is in a great view. So anyway, here's the video. It's about 3 minutes. Oh, hey, one more slide. So I'll talk about this for just a moment. As you can kind of see just from the size of some of the other camps we've looked at, you can see how the legionary camp would have occupied the area known as the Temple Mount. And that's really all this illustration is showing. So here's the video. Yeah, the other thing too is we've already mentioned Fort Antonio, but what I find fascinating is they have a model at the Israeli Museum.
Yes.
And I'm sure you've seen it.
Yeah,
the Temple
model.
Mount.
Yes.
And you have Fort Antonio right there to the side, small little. And for me, listening to you prior to the recording, for me, that's a very important point because
yes.
A 10th Legion,
yes.
Right? Am I correct? Possibly 6,000 to 10,000 men.
Yes.
You know, it's just really impossible. So I think that's a very important point. The size that would be required for that type of legion or that type of military would not be sufficient for what they're showing at the Israeli Museum.
Yes, and Josephus tells us that Fort Antonio was much larger in scope than the temple itself. He said from the northern side, it blocked the temple, and he said it was
now
so...
Now, this is coming north.
Yes, exactly. This is coming north to south, okay. So we're seeing it. And he says it was so large, it was as large as a city, actually several cities. Mm-hmm. And we were just up there a little while ago,
absolutely.
And you could see it. You could see when you're up there really how large it really is.
And for the Romans, a fort like that, they would have, it's almost like a small city. City
yes.
Within the fort.
The inward parts had the largeness and form of a palace, it being parted into all kinds of rooms and other conveniences, such as courts and places for bathing, and broad spaces for camps, insomuch that by having all conveniences that cities wanted, it might seem to be composed of several cities, but by its magnificence it seemed a palace. Flavius Josephus, War of the Jews.
The Romans and the Jews do not intermingle whatsoever. So the Roman soldiers that are here, and any other Romans that are here that are helping them, they would be not only in the fort for times of military, they're living in there. Their barracks are going to be in there. Their housing is going to be in there. Their markets are going to be in there. Their temple is going to be in there. Every single thing of the facet of their life is going to be inside that little city more than a fort.
And the model, again, going back to this Israeli Museum, what's your guess? 200-300 men at most?
At most.
And, you know, based on the projections, at least what you believe, and I want to go home, I want to do some reading because this is very, very fascinating.
Yes.
You're saying 6,000 to 10,000 men.
Which is a legion of troops. And when you look in Josephus, the word that's used for legion, 6,000 troops, every single place in Josephus is translated as legion, mm-hmm. except when you come to the Temple Mount, they change the word to cohort because it just doesn't fit.
Now, what's the difference between cohort?
A cohort is 600 compared 600. To a legion is 6,000.
Okay. That's quite a difference.
Yes.
That's quite
but
a difference.
But tagma is the Greek word that they
okay.
use. So it really should be legion. Every other place, it's legion.
The other thing, too, is we've already... Okay, or if you want to see more, you'll have to log on to YouTube. This is an amazing video, by the way. To show you the story behind that, Elder Don and I, he was our guide, and or part of our guide, and we were at the hotel that the evening before. We were talking just about doing something. You know, let's do a video, so we said, well, we'll do a video on the Mount of Olives, and I said, you can share with me, because at that time, truthfully, I was not an advocate of this belief. I was still kind of the persuasion that the Temple Mount was a location, but what he said was fascinating. So I said, let's do a video. And so it was, there was absolutely no planning with this. And it just kind of shows you how Yahweh moves sometimes. I think we have 2.5 million views so far of this. It's really amazing. And I think it's helping, hopefully, people realize that what we... see there at the Temple Mount is not the Temple Mount, historically speaking. Now, before closing, I promised I was going to share with you something called the Paul Dilemma. I want to share that with you now. So in Acts 23, verse 10, we find Paul in the temple, and we find that a dispute arose. And we find that the soldiers were sent down to gather Paul, bring him up to the fort. So as it says there, the dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn in pieces by them, the Jews. He ordered the troops to go down. To go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barrack. Then he called two of his centurions and ordered them, get ready a detachment of, listen, it says 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. So they came down from the temple, or from the fortress, from Fortress Antonia, to gather Paul, because again, they were afraid Paul would be torn apart by the crowd and by the dispute. When this happened, again, the troops came down. They brought Paul up to the fort. And then later, we find here that the commander was commanding that they take 470 men and escort Paul to Caesarea. Now, I think Caesarea is about an hour drive, anyway, from Jerusalem. It's not real far. Beautiful place, by the way. It's one of the places I've just really always enjoyed. It was a Roman territory. In fact, Pilate had his palace there at Caesarea. It's beautiful. Anyway, 2 points here. Number one, we see here that the soldiers came down from the barracks or from the fort to gather Paul. Now, again, based on the current model, there's no going down. They're side by side. There's no difference in height. But Josephus says that Fortress Antonia was located on the third highest hill. Of course, the model shows them the same level. But here we see in the Bible that they came down. So this shows, this provides evidence that the fortress was higher than the temple. And that's not what we find from the Israeli Museum. Number two, we see here the 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen escorted Paul from Jerusalem to Caesarea. And again, that's about an hour away, I believe. And of course, it took them a bit longer than it would take us. Now, let's do the math real quick here. 470 men. Now, consider this. It's believed by most that the 10th Legion was a cohort in that it consisted of 600 men. So you have 600 men total to guard the city. And you're going to take 470 of these men and you're going to escort one man to Caesarea. That's why I call this the Paul Dilemma. Because it really is a dilemma for those who believe this. How do you justify this? Let me share the numbers with you. So, if you do the math, 470 men, and assuming there's 600 total, that's 78%. So they would devote 78% of their military to escort one man. And it's not like Paul had a past of being violent. 470 men from Jerusalem to Caesarea, 78% of their military. That just doesn't make any sense. But if it was 6,000 men, what does the math look like? So 6,000 men, it would be 7.8%. That's still pretty high. And 470 men, that's quite a few men. But Paul was not liked. But 7.8%. So which number seems more reasonable to you? Do you believe that the Romans would have justifiably used 78% of their military to escort one man to Caesarea? Or is it more reasonable to believe that they would have used 7.8% of their military to escort one man to Caesarea? Well, the answer should be obvious. 70% makes no sense at all. It's nonsensical. 7.8% makes much more sense. Much more reasonable number. You know, when we consider all the evidence, it seems highly unlikely that today's Temple Mount is the biblical or historical place where the temple stood. It's much, much likely that the traditional Temple Mount that we see today was the location of an ancient Roman fort called Fortress Antonia. And which would mean, like, the Wailing Wall would be part of the fort, not of the old temple. Now, I want to review some points of why believing that the traditional Temple Mount is the place of the temple is just, again, nonsensical. The ancient city of David's is synonymous with Zion, Salem, and Mount Moriah. And as we know, Zion is synonymous with the temple location. So from a biblical standpoint, as we saw in last message, from a biblical standpoint, we know that the city of David is Jerusalem. We know that the city of David is Mount, is Zion. And we know that the city of David is also called Mount Moriah. And we also know that the temple was within Zion. So from a biblical standpoint, the Bible certainly points to the city of David. And again, remember that the city of David was the original Jerusalem. That was the original Jerusalem. So if you want to go to the old Jerusalem, you go to the city of David. Old Jerusalem really is not the oldest Jerusalem. The oldest Jerusalem is, again, the city of David. Also, the lack of evidence of a threshing floor under the Dome of the Rock, because, again, it's believed that the Dome of the Rock is where the temple was. And we know that it was built over, worn on the Jebusite over his threshing floor. And we know that a threshing floor had to be what? It had to be smooth. And you saw last message, you saw a picture of underneath the Temple Mount, or underneath the Dome of the Rock. It is not smooth. We also know that 70 Jewish families from the 7th century identified the city of David as the location of the temple and also the Pool of Siloam. These people were not that far removed. They knew still where the temple was historically, because the Islamic ruler said, "Where do you want to go?" And they said, "We want to go to the city of David where the temple was." The fact that the only natural water source was the Gihon Spring, which is a third of a mile away from the traditional Temple Mount, again, sheds serious doubt that the Temple Mount location is where the temple stood. There's no water source. There's certainly not from an ancient standpoint. Now, I know they have reservoirs now they've built, but from a historical standpoint, there's no natural water source. The only natural water source is the Gihon Spring. And without the Gihon Spring, there would be no city today, certainly not what we see today. Also, the fact that we have two historians, and possibly more, speaking about a spring-like reservoir gushing up from within the temple. Again, we saw this from who? We saw this from Aristeus. He was a Jewish historian, 2nd, 3rd century BCE. And we also saw this from Tacitus, a 2nd century historian, Roman historian, in the century 2 CE. We also see Joshua's prophecy and supporting historical evidence showing and stating of the utter destruction that the temple and the city of David at Jerusalem would suffer by the Romans. Again, Joshua said not one stone would remain upon another. And from scholarship, Josephus, Eusebius, Epiphanius, and others, they all say that there was nothing left. It was desolate. It was utterly ruined. It was like Sodom. And yet again, you look at the Temple Mount today, you have the foundation there, just pristine. And you have that Wailing Wall, that big Wailing Wall, that would have never remained. Now lastly here, for me, we find a contradiction between the proposed Fortress Antonia of today and what we see from Josephus. Understand, historically, you have to put Fortress Antonia somewhere. You have to put Fortress Antonia somewhere. We know historically that Fortress Antonia existed, and that's why the Jews, they had to put this somewhere. So they added it as this small appendage. But as we see historically, it would never fit within this small appendage. It was 6,000 men, minimum. And again, as we know from historians, a Roman fort would be like a city. Again, like a large military base today. And it would have and contain everything you would need. You would never need to leave that fort. And there's just the thought that that model is correct is just, again, nonsensical. Now, I promised a quiz. I always deliver upon my promises. Try to, anyway. So we're going to move toward our quiz here. I appreciate everybody's focus and the fun there on the quiz. So may Yahweh bless you.